Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hello, I'm Steph. Welcome to episode 42 of Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. I'm joined today by the full crew. That's Linda, Teresa, Nicola, Heather and Pat.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
We have another packed agenda for you. Nicola's going to be reading from her work in progress, and then we'll offer her some feedback, just the way we do in our regular Write Club meetings. Teresa is planning to poke some gentle fun at that doyen of contemporary English authors, Faye Weldon, no less. We'll be discussing secondary characters in storytelling, those characters who help move your story along. Maybe they motivate or foil your protagonist and add an extra dimension to the world you've created. And then at the end of the show, we'll hear what Laura Marshall, the author of Friend Request and Three Little Lies, is reading at the moment. And Heather will tell us what's on her bedside table too. But first, Pat is going to ask us to...
name the novel.
I think this one's fairly easy. But I have been proved wrong before. So, clue number one. This is the autobiography of a female American author, which was first published in 1969 and became an immediate bestseller. It was nominated for a National Book Award in 1970, and in 2011, Time magazine placed the book in its list of 100 best and most influential books written in English since 1923. That's all one.
The only thing that I'm unsure is the date sounded a bit early for what I've got in mind, but then I may be wrong.
1969,
you said?
But
I think the only one. Women's room, but it can't be, really.
No. Is it, did you say biography or autobiography?
Autobiography. Okay. Ready for number two? Many parents throughout the US have sought to ban the book from schools and libraries for being inappropriate for younger high school students, for promoting premarital sex, homosexuality, cohabitation and pornography, and for not supporting traditional values. Parents have also objected to the book's use of profanity and to its graphic and violent depiction of rape and racism.
Oh my God.
Okay. Teresa's getting there.
Well, I still only have one book in mind, but I can't remember any... great detail, but there is certainly sexual violence in the one I have in mind.
Okay, number three. This covers the author's life from the ages of 3 to 16, during which the author becomes an elective mute for 5 years.
Definitely.
Following her rape by her mother's boyfriend. It was followed by 6 more instalments of her autobiography.
Yes. It's I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings by Maya Angelou. I didn't realise it was published as early as that, but it was,
good for you, Teresa. Yeah.
You didn't get it, Linda?
No, I didn't.
You might get it.
I had a glimmer, but I couldn't remember her name.
Maya Angelou, brilliant writer. Okay, thanks for that, Pat. Now, we're going to hear from Nicola. Nicola's going to read an excerpt from her work in progress. Can you tell us a bit about this scene, Nicola?
Yes, it's actually two of my secondary characters, who are rapidly becoming more interesting than the main protagonist to me, I must say. You remember that there are 11 races in the Galactic Federation at the moment, which is run by Alok the Third, and they are desperately looking for a 12th race so that they can ascend to a higher level in the cosmos. And the problem is that the most likely candidates have just been completely wiped out. They've had a report back that 60 billion souls have been annihilated in a week by an ancient evil that is as yet identified. So Alok the Third is now inviting Rex, who is Brianne, who's going to be Brianne's mentor, in her personal journey, and Rex is on his own personal journey, as in Alok. So this is the time when Alok tells Rex what's happened and the implications of that. Ah, come in, Rex. A wee dram? I know you're keen on a drop of the single malt. Alok the Third started to pour without waiting for an answer. Aye, that I am. No water, thanks. Since that trip round the Highland distilleries in the footsteps of your man, Ian Banks, I've been very keen indeed. What a wonderful holiday in search of the perfect dram. The book has really stood the test of time. Hardly anything's changed since Ian himself did that trip. Rex sunk into a battered old leather armchair with a tartan car blanket casually thrown over the back, noting the nice touch by Alok. Alok himself sat, or rather seemed to wrap himself around something that looked rather like an old tree stump. He had a small whiskey too. Now, sir, I know you're not going to all this trouble to make me feel comfortable because you've got something good to tell me. Sharp as ever, Rex, no, it's not good news, especially as you've been looking forward to your own ascension. But we've just had some terrible, terrible news that changes everything. Alok looked down as if wondering where to begin, but really he was trying to compose himself. Obviously, what I tell you now must stay between us, Rex, or there'll be utter panic throughout the galaxy. Word will get out soon enough, but I must tell the Federation. They must be put in the picture first, bleak as it is. But you've arrived for your evaluation, just as I've heard myself. 60 billion of the most promising souls around, right now, just gone. Snuffed out in under a week, all of them. What? How? Who? Spluttered Rex, for once losing his customary cool. Dead. All gone. I just heard from O'Kelly Isley Jr., who happened to be passing, and found a great big nothing where a glorious planetary aura should be. He's done a full reconnaissance on my orders, and the probes on Strawberry Letter 23 have confirmed it. All life extinguished. Rex just sat there like a statue. It was a disaster of such epic proportions, it was apparent that even his enhanced brain struggled to take it in. But what could do that? Was it one of the Federation? No, that's unthinkable, surely. It's very unlikely it was one of us. I can't believe it. What would be the motive? The cause seems to be a variation of the old human disease, Alzheimer's, but heavily mutated. There were enough news broadcasts recorded before it got everyone to work it out, and the air samples confirm it. Mutated or, heaven forbid, deliberately let loose. People just got really confused really quickly and either stopped looking after themselves or got really violent. The kids and babies didn't stand a chance. I can't bear to think about it. Are you really saying it could be deliberate, Alok? Rex sat as if he'd been nailed to the chair, just looking in horror at the man who'd run the Federation for the last few thousand years. Nobody had ever seen Alok show any negative emotion. But he now sat there with tears running unashamedly down his barky old face, staring off into the distance as if he could see it all happening right before him.
Yeah. Wow. I was really intrigued with Alok being able to wrap himself around something that looked rather like a tree stump. What form has he taken?
Well, it's funny you should say that. I haven't worked it out yet.
You just like the image.
But you'd like some description, would you, to make it apparent?
Well, yeah, I was wondering, okay, is he just some sort of blob that molds itself, or is he...
I'm largely concentrating on avoiding adverbs right now, but I think I will come back and add some more description.
When did he become Irish? Did he become Irish?
Did I get Irish? I was meaning to be Scottish. No, I lost my way on the accent. Completely.
No, Alok became kind of Irish.
He did?
I thought.
Oh, yeah?
But then he sort of switched out of it.
Yeah, well, that's my bad accent.
No, I did. Not so much in the reading of it, but not in your reading of it, but in private reading of it. You know what I mean?
Oh, in your head?
The phraseology, yeah.
Oh, it's supposed to be Scottish. Or Scots.
Yeah, I got that in the other guy's, Rex's. Thing.
Yeah,
well, perhaps it's you're keen on a drop of the. It sounds a bit of an Irish kind
keen,
of phrase.
Keen on a drop of the dram.
Maybe something like that.
That sounds Irish too.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I didn't think that, but it's kind of a little bit.
Yeah.
I wonder why an alien would have an Irish accent anyway, or an Irish. but there you go. That's another point.
But these guys. Well, they can be anywhere.
The point is that they're all, in the Federation. They're all obsessed with human.
Right.
You know, remember we did the vote and they were all obsessed with humanity and they'd all taken on roles and things. Yeah.
Right.
So basically Rex has just been on holiday in the Highlands and Alok's trying to make his room look as welcoming as possible
for him. I see. I felt that passage about around the Highlands and the Ian Banks, I've been very keen, what a wonderful holiday. I really felt that was kind of a research dump. It didn't really feel to me like...
It felt like a product placement.
Yes.
To me.
I just said I'm not sure it adds anything. I know that, you know, it's kind of an homage for you because you love Ian Banks and you love that book.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really fit
I felt it was an information dump of a bit of research.
I didn't like the Ian Banks name in there.
Right.
Because it's a too familiar literary name. I thought it was a little distracting for me because...
I think it would have to be done more subtly.
Yeah, okay.
Anybody else? Anything?
Did I swap points of view anywhere?
Yes, you did.
Yeah. One of my main problems.
Aylott looked down as if wondering where to begin, but really he was trying to... trying to compose himself.
Yeah.
Until then, you'd been very neatly with Rex,
and then
suddenly we know what Aylott is thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But that could be Rex... thinking he's observing Aylott looking down as if wondering where to begin.
Well, that's
make it more obvious.
Maybe.
When it says, but really, he was trying to compose himself.
You're right.
So that is a slip of point of view. And I was going to say, could you, Aylott looked down. I'm not sure you need to say as if he was wondering where to begin. You could actually have him look down, chew his lips, look up, take a big sigh.
Show not tell.
I would suggest. But yeah, I thought that was a slip of point of view.
You just have to decide what he looks like before you can.
Because he can't shrug his shoulders or gulp if he hasn't got any, can he?
Yeah.
In the next thing, you've got what, who, how, spluttered Rex.
Yeah,
for once losing his customary cool.
Yeah.
You don't need to tell us he's losing his customary cool because he's spluttered.
Right.
Sounded a bit cliched.
Yeah, it did.
We seem to have picked up the same things.
Okay,
which is good.
I guess all these X's are a profanity that you chose
they're the race name of the ones who've just been wiped out. I haven't had time to work out what they are.
There was a couple of places where I noticed you said just Rex just sat there like a statue.
Yeah, okay.
So actually Rex sat as if he'd been nailed to the chair, just looking horror.
Yeah.
I'm not sure just adds anything to text.
Right.
And a format thing. You've got Rex sat there. Rex just sat there like a statue. It was a disaster of such epic proportions. It was apparent that even his enhanced brain struggled to take it in. Another slip of point of view. But what could do that? Was it one of the Federations? Is actually in quotes. But because it's on a separate line, I assumed it was Aylott speaking.
Mm.
Whereas actually, you could keep it in the same paragraph as Rex above it's Rex speaking.
Yeah.
I mean, I worked it out because obviously the response was... It's very unlikely it was one of us. Similarly, you've got Rex looking in horror. And again, I think you could show
he
looked in horror.
Yeah.
And you've got adverb, ashamedly, tears running unashamedly down his barky old face. I don't think you need to say unashamedly. I think the fact that he's got tears running down his face shows he's unashamed. He's staring into
those
the distance.
Pesky adverbs, they creep in everything.
Anybody else got...
Well, you're talking a lot about, and rightly so, about using facial expressions to describe emotion rather than just say somebody... And I've had so much trouble trying to figure out how to describe some of the facial expressions that people have. All I can get seems to be every time there's something other than joy, you knit your eyebrows.
it's not just facial expression, is it? It's body language as well.
But also,
knitting
your eyebrows once upon a time, I'm not sure if it comes from Shakespeare, but would have been a very original image of knitting your eyebrows.
Yeah.
But now it doesn't really mean anything, does it?
No.
It's just,
so your brows furrowed.
But
you can
I think
say, but what?
There's a wonderful book... And I can't remember who wrote it, but it's called What Everybody Is Saying.
Oh, yeah.
And I will post a link on the Facebook group.
Do.
And it's a book about body language. It was written by an American guy who's in the FBI. And, how they're trained to spot when people are lying. And it's things like where people put their feet.
Yeah.
What people do with their whole bodies. And I found that really useful.
I've heard of that
book.
That would be great.
Yeah, What Everybody Is Saying. I've got it. I think it might be a Kindle version, but I have the book. I think you'll find that very useful. It's quite a useful resource.
Yeah.
I know I used one in particular in part of my writing where there's a boy and he's being challenged by his father for being a bit sulky and he doesn't take his eyes off his father, but he puts his feet, his 2 feet behind... tucks his feet underneath and hooks them round the legs of the chair from behind, while he's sitting in the chair. And I remember, I can't remember what it meant, but I got that from this, what everybody is saying. But
yeah.
So that's quite a useful
thing. It's body language, isn't it? Men tend to open their legs when they're wanting to dominate
other
people.
Yeah, but he was hooking his feet round the back to sort of in deference to his father, I guess. Oh, I don't know.
And in Sam Blake's first book, she's obviously got that, the book you're talking about, she does that, you know, with somebody that if they tell lies, they do a certain, you know, mannerism each time. I found that fascinating.
I think it is a good thing to kind of, to try and find the clichés in your own work. Sometimes I do that and I think, oh, that's a bit of a cliché, how can I say that differently? But sometimes writers just, instead of just saying somebody smiled, they'll say, you know, they opened their mouth wide and showed their teeth. And sometimes you can they just smile. It's a balance, isn't it?
It's the same with the adverbs. You said, there are rules, but you don't have to all the time.
Yeah.
And we use adverbs in conversation. So if you're describing a real conversation,
if it's speech, then people have to speak as they would say.
That's right.
I didn't have much to add, really. I did think where you say Rex sat as if he'd been nailed to the chair and stared in horror at the man who had run the Federation for the last few thousand years. Is he a man? That kind of brought me up. Other than that, there's a couple of little punctuation things which I'll just give you my notes.
Down the pile of things to worry about.
Exactly. But so that was all really. I think
I'm struggling a little bit with this because I'm feeling that it's all a bit too light-hearted, and I'm trying to inject some horror. Well, not horror, but I'm trying to inject some tension into it.
I have the same problem. It's a very difficult balance, isn't it? If you go down the line of something being a bit humorous, but then dark things come in, but I don't know how you resolve that really. Some writers do it very well, you know, and having a light touch humor, and then there are some horrific events. I mean, you know, Nelson Algren is good at that, I think, you know, because he there's a lot of humour in his books, but they're basically quite tragic. So, like The Man with the Golden Arm, there are some hilarious things in that, but it's actually very, very dark.
But Atkinson does it really well. You know, she keeps it light a lot of the time, but then there's lots of horrid things happening to her characters, and she manages to not be flippant. I sort of feel like I'm a bit flippant. I don't know. I'm having a.
But maybe that's the correct tone for this piece, 60 Million Lives. You know, a bit like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where the Earth is.
I absolutely want to avoid sounding like that in any way.
Yeah. I'm not saying it is. Yeah. I didn't. But you know, I see what you mean. Yeah. Okay, well, that's not not a good analogy for you.
Okay, thank you, Nicola.
No problem.
Hope that was useful feedback.
Yes.
Now, Teresa, you wanted to talk to us, or you wanted to poke a bit of fun at...
Well...
A very well-known contemporary
English author. With absolute respect and admiration. It's just a little bit of fun I have. So Faye Weldon has got a new book out, Why Will No One Publish My Novel? And reportedly...
Oh, I could have written that.
Well, maybe we all need to read it. Not suggesting, you know, I mean, it's had great reviews, and I know one person's read it and said it's absolutely brilliant, it's wonderful. But she was quoted in the newspaper as sort of some of her top tips. And again, this may have been a misquote, but it said... she was quoted as suggesting use lots of words with double Z.
Right.
So I had a look. There are over 350 words in the English language using double Z.
She reckons if we use words with double Zs, we'll get published.
More attention catching. But it may be tongue-in-cheek. It may be tongue-in-cheek. I haven't read the book.
In the title, are we talking about here? Or in the
I think it might be in the opening. But anyway, So I've had a go at writing a little opening of a story that doesn't go anywhere, but it's got lots of words with double Z in. Not 350. I haven't managed to use all 350. But I'll just read it.
Oh, good.
So I've called it the Paparazzi Pizza Puzzler. The blizzard whizzed around Lizzie as she buzzed the buzzer. The door was opened by the last person she expected to see, Jez the Fez Dembezzler. She felt dizzy. In spite of herself, she was dazzled by his grizzled beard and his frizzled locks. Sadly, his muzzle had grown more wizened since last they met. He spoke somewhat fuzzily, and she wondered, is he sozzled?
Have you forgotten me, Jez? She puzzled. Where's your pizzazz? Remember how we guzzled mozzarella and gizzards on the mezzanine of the palazzo? We danced to jazz with the Lezzies, Izzy and Ezzy. Your brother Ozzy nuzzled Izzy, briefly outdazzling Ezzy in her eyes. I was puzzled by the pizzicato intermezzo. Of course, says Jez. I was dazzled by your bajazzle. Brilliant. Later, we lost several quizzes to the scuzzy rozzers, the ones with the massive schnozzles. What a swizz.
Yeah, that is absolutely brilliant. Well done.
Wonderful.
Well, we must put that, we will put that on the Facebook group.
Yes, absolutely.
As an homage to Faye Weldon.
Absolutely. Yeah. I intend to read the book. I believe it will be very helpful.
Right, we'll all look forward to reading the book,
yeah.
And perhaps if you've got a top tip for how to get us published, and you've got something like that with lots of double Z's in,
yeah, have a go.
Have a go and post it on Facebook. And where did you find these 350 words with double Z?
I just Googled words with double Z. There's a list.
It's so easy.
The great God Google.
Yes. The great God Google. Yeah.
Google is
actually
wonderful.
I don't use Google. I use Ecosia. But it's
what?
The same thing.
Ecosia.
It's the environmentally friendly search engine that plants trees every time you use it.
Oh,
it should have been called Ecosia.
Yeah, double Z.
No, double Z.
Yeah.
But yeah. Would have got more
I did
attention.
An online search.
Ah, all right. Yeah.
Fantastic. Well done. Thank you very much. Okay, and now we're coming to the meat of the programme. We're going to talk about secondary characters. We spend a lot of time talking about protagonists, but today we're going to talk about that important supporting cast who very often are a foil or a support. They're normally very different from the central character. Linda, you've been thinking about the role of the secondary character, haven't you?
I have, because I'm at the point where I want to introduce one of my own in... I just, I need to know more information about what the role is, and so I looked up the role of secondary characters, or the purpose they have, and there was a lot of good information out there, and I need to give credit to some of these websites that I took stuff from. I looked for copyright things, but I didn't find them, so anyway, I got a lot of information from Mary Keeley at a site called Books and Such. And Abigail Perry at Do It Yourself Master of Fine Arts. And Stephanie Vardavas at I Read Books. And she's shared that on Quora, the website Quora. But and thank you, all these wonderful learned people who allow me to learn from you. So the role of secondary characters, number one, they move the plot forward. Two, they reveal information or give greater insight about major characters. And three, they set the tone of a scene. These are the things they're supposed to do. So, but you think, and even though they're secondary, they every one of these stress, they need to be fully developed. You need to have your bio of them that you've done for your backstory the same in the same in-depth way as you've done for your major characters. Because so it's just being sloppy if you treat them less than fully rounded. So secondary characters then are a tool, you say, that writers can use. You can create difficult situations, you can create challenges, or you can uncover important information through secondary character. They basically have the obligation to influence the plot in one of the three ways we mentioned. So they can really help to give insight into a character's personality. If they know something that the main character doesn't know, or if they know something of the main characters that they don't want revealed, or it could be a childhood friend or a sports rival, the housekeeper, another family member, any secondary character you choose to carry this kind of load, that would be a way. And they can add tension if they cast suspicion on help, you know, to help bring the plot around or a plot twist. Though sometimes it might be awkward for a main character to show his or her challenge and why it's hard for them, why they struggle to meet their challenge. It could slow the pace when you don't want the pace slowed if you're having the main character try to reveal all of this stuff. Mm. So a secondary character can give you that information in a more efficient way, and it would help to deepen the reader's sympathy of the main character. They give a couple of episodes, which I've stolen, examples of secondary characters moving the plot forward. I really appreciate the examples because we can talk all the time about, oh, they can move the plot forward, they can do all of this. But, and so this one really jumped at me from Romeo and Juliet, Tybalt. If Romeo hadn't killed him in a fit of rage,
the families wouldn't have been arguing.
Right. They would have just accepted him as a son. He and Juliet wouldn't need to have hide their love. So what? There was no story. Mm-hmm. There's no story. So Tybalt was a very important secondary character.
And you can kill off those secondary characters, I guess, because you don't need them all the way through.
That's
the story.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to say, is he a character or is he just an incident, an inciting incident or something? But, you know,
him to bring something about.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So another one example was Melanie in Gone with the Wind. Yes. Because even though she has all of this information piling up about a romance between Ashley and Scarlett, she just doesn't act on it, or either she pretends she doesn't know it or whatever. And she'd rather not have it be true, I suppose. But you never know how much she really knows. But she creates tension because had it not been for Melanie, Scarlett could have just married Ashley and there would not have been a plot, because that was such a large part of the plot. Scarlett wanting so much to
have her own way.
Yeah, with Ashley. Yeah. So that's a good example, I think, as well of how a secondary character can really influence the plot.
Mm-hmm.
And the third one, I think, that they offered was Tiny Tim in A Christmas Carol.
Yeah.
And he advances the plot because he acts as a trigger for Scrooge's sympathy. You know, at one point, Scrooge, who was it he was asking, you know, what's going to, he saw the vision or something.
Yeah,
what's
the ghost of Christmas yet to come.
Yeah, what's going to happen?
Showed him that Tiny Tim could be dead.
Yeah. Right, right. And so he really, he was interested in, I don't know why Scrooge decided to be nice at that point, but he
I've always wondered that as well. Yeah. Well, because they showed him in the story, they showed him that he would end up unloved and uncared for, and he'd die alone, and Tiny Tim would be dead, and so on. And
I thought he was unloved and alone
already. Yeah, you know, I had exactly the same reaction when I read that,
Okay. But anyway.
Poor Mr. Dickens isn't here to defend him.
No, we can't critique him.
Well, we can. Tell us we're wrong, can we?
And Tiny Tim never really speaks to Scrooge, but he gives insight into the man Scrooge could be if he abandons his cold-hearted ways.
I think in A Christmas Carol as well, the nephew who...
Fred.
Is it his name Fred?
I think so.
Yeah, the nephew who invites Uncle Ebenezer to Christmas lunch.
Uh-huh.
I think he's quite a good secondary character because he's... he's kind of saying, I'm still going to... You're looking at me like you don't understand what I'm talking about, Nicola. the nephew says to Scrooge, you know, please come to lunch. We want you to be part of the family. Mm. And so he is actually giving Ebenezer Scrooge that way out, because he has got somewhere he can go and start rebuilding bridges.
Right, right.
Whereas, you know...
I have to confess that my head's not in any literary sense, you know, thinking about this. I'm just thinking about a Muppet's Christmas Carol. That's what the story
is.
Michael Caine becoming a nice man at the end.
So are the Ugly Sisters secondary characters, or are they the antagonists?
Well, Cinderella is the main character, and the Ugly Sisters
are the antagonists.
Yeah.
So Prince Charming is the secondary character.
Yeah, my.
He never gets very well drawn at all, does he? I mean, yeah.
The antagonists can be secondary characters. Or secondary characters can be antagonists, I suppose.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because a secondary character would perhaps foil or put an obstacle up. So.
And the stepmother, right? She was.
Yeah.
Cinderella's stepmother.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was a.
Well, in Harry Potter, we've got Hermione, we've got Ron, the Weasleys.
Yeah,
they're all wonderful secondary characters, aren't they?
Yeah. And the
teachers.
The uncle.
The adopted parents of Harry Potter.
All sorts of great secondary characters there.
Yeah.
I think I was thinking about To Kill a Mockingbird. And I started thinking, because they've got some like good secondary characters. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, just how many secondary good and memorable secondary characters there are. And they all perform, ultimately I think they all perform the same function in as much as they kind of guide scout through growing up. Right. But they provide different roles as well.
Yeah, learning compassion from having to read to the old lady and the consideration for Boo Radley and all of those things, respecting people who are different.
We don't see him till the end.
Right. But he moves everything along because the kids are always afraid of him running, trying to, you know.
They spend the summer, whole of the summer, isn't it, is trying to get Boo Radley to come out.
Out of the house.
Yeah. Lots of the adventures kind of arise out of that.
Yeah. Right, right.
But they do, they play a part.
He's a sort of legendary character, isn't he? And then he, in the end, he comes out and saves Jem.
Yeah,
but he has so much there that he creates so much tension.
Yes, he does.
Even though we're not seeing him.
Yeah.
Any more examples?
Well, we were talking to Sam Blake, weren't we? And she said that her protagonist grew out of a secondary character initially.
That's right.
And that's what I'm finding is I'm now much more interested in my secondary characters than I am in my protagonist.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sort of kind of thinking about my secondary characters. And for me, in A Village Called Faraway, there are lots of characters because I'm trying to create a village. And I think the third point you made about setting the tone of the scene is important.
Yeah.
But also, you know, I mean, thinking about why did I introduce this character, Costas, who's the old school friend of Elpida, who's now the village president and quite self-important, but also he thinks he's going to get romantically involved with Elpida and she's not interested. And I think, why did I bring him in? And I think maybe I wanted somebody to be romantically interested in Elpida, but not somebody that she would take seriously. Uh-huh. I just wanted to give her that. Also, I mean, without secondary characters, what have you got?
Yeah.
You know, you'd have a very limited.
That's right.
So they're bringing colour and
right.
And it's important to have
variety
and their backstory and their motivations, because that's where you can create tension when you've got two characters, both with different agendas and different motives, as we've talked about before in our memorable drama workshop, where you've got when you've got two characters that have got. So, for example, with Grace. And Sister Burton. Sister Burton is a secondary character.
Uh-huh.
Now, I know, but the reader will never be told, that Sister Burton grew up as the younger sister of a brother. Her brother died after the First World War. Not as a direct result of the First World War, but that had a big effect on him. She wanted to be a doctor, but her parents didn't consider that it was worth educating girls, and so she became a nurse, because that was the closest thing she could do. But she's like the sister and the, you know, that's her backstory. Now, that will never be disclosed to the reader, but because I know that, I give her certain, like, she uses Latin expressions occasionally, which is a kind of pretension towards the kind of medical person she would have liked to have been, and so on. And she's actually quite educated beyond her nursing practice. She's quite educated. So I know all this.
And she thinks she's as good as the doctor.
Yes, she does.
So she doesn't sort of kowtow to
them. Yeah, so she thinks she's got. She does kowtow to them, but she also has an opinion of her own and isn't afraid to take Grace to one side and have a little chat with her.
Yeah.
But I find it much easier when I've done that when I've understood where that character's coming from. And I've got other secondary characters like Peggy and Eddie, who are literally there to make things happen around Grace. Yeah. Because I didn't want everything to happen to Grace. You know? So you need other women that are being put in straitjackets or, you know, getting into other pickles. So otherwise it would sound like a misery manual. All these awful things happen to Grace. So there has to, and there has to be other patients, and there has to be a variety of patients and different people with different stories. A bit like your village. Trying to create a hospital ward.
My story about Daniel and everything happened to poor Daniel.
You've had to get
everything that could go wrong went wrong for that one person, and split it up into separate stories.
Different characters, the challenges.
One of the things that I want to do and that I need to do is look at, I've got the sort of overall plot of the novel, the main theme, if you like. But I think the secondary characters also need a story arc within that. So when we meet Tula, who's Elpida's friend, you know, she's not massively unhappy, but she's a bit bored and with life and dissatisfied in her marriage. So something needs to happen to her somewhere along the line to resolve that or make things better or worse or whatever. So I'd like to sometime sit down and work out over the period of the novel what's happening to many of the characters, maybe not everyone, but and also because I have got these other stories within the main story, as you know. So
I think these websites, the people that I've borrowed some of this from, called it a mini arc, you know.
Okay,
you have the three act structure, and but then, which is called what? What kind of arc is that?
Story arc?
Yeah.
Just guessing.
No, it's a normal world. Inciting incident to change, working through the change and then the resolution, the moral choice crisis,
the hero's journey. In other words,
lots of different ways of referring.
But we found when we sat and put our secondary characters down the left and worked out their story arcs, it actually helped us fill in gaps in the plot, didn't it?
It did. And that was thanks to you, because you just kept saying, come on, what's that?
What's happening with Drupal? What's little dog's motivation here?
Well, I'm looking forward to getting to know some of these characters, which at the moment are just names.
Yeah.
So that's going to be interesting as you introduce us to them over the next few months, hopefully.
I think so.
Some of them.
I really, really admire what Steph's done, because you wrote a background. I mean, you wrote the background of all of your secondary characters, didn't you? I mean, the main ones, you know. And so I think it really helps if you know that personality.
I think you have to, otherwise.
Yeah.
Otherwise they all talk and sound the same.
Uh-huh.
And they're just going to read like ciphers. Yes, just, right. They're there for a purpose. Oh, yes, they're there to show this aspect of so-and-so's character.
Right. Yeah.
They're there to do such and such, and that becomes obvious, and then adds to our enjoyment
enormously, doesn't it? As a reader, if there's all these different rich characters going on,
whether that world's a ward or a village or whatever.
Yeah, and what I've done, as you've followed along with me, because I haven't done that biography for my main characters, Eli's personality has changed 3 or 4 times.
He's starting to get a different background, and in the recent work in progress that we have from Linda, you know, we see a fun side of Eli, which we haven't seen before. So he's evolving.
Yeah, he was downright nasty at the beginning.
Was awful. He was terrible. But
maybe something was going on in his life that made him uncomfortable. Because that's when they were still back in
Papa,
where they came from. So maybe there was something there that was making him uncomfortable. Now he's on the road and free,
and
getting further away from that place. Maybe now he's feeling more comfortable. Who knows? I mean, that could be.
Well, I'll have to write his biographical sketch in order to find out for myself, because I've even changed his appearance.
Yeah, I think doing that is start, and I certainly did it with Sister Burton, because what I was really afraid of was Nurse Ratched.
Oh,
I did not want a Nurse Ratched character, because that to me, although It was done beautifully in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Uh-huh. It is now a cliche.
Yeah.
When you're writing, when you read about asylums, there's always a Nurse Ratched type
and also
character.
A little bit misogynistic.
Yes.
Yeah. You know. Yeah.
And I absolutely wanted everybody that comes into contact with Grace to be doing their best.
Yes.
Because right. I don't believe that many people actively go to work thinking I'm going to do the worst
right,
I can.
Right.
I think everybody that she came into contact with was probably trying to do their job. Yeah. So that was why I found it was important. I felt it was important, particularly with Sister Burton, to understand where she was coming from.
Yeah.
So that she wouldn't be a caricature or a cliche.
And
so,
you were trying to stay away from another one. What was it you said you?
I don't want to be too light-hearted. I don't want to be.
Oh, but you were staying away from some novel.
Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Yeah.
And I am constantly watching and afraid that I might be. I don't want to get too close to Addie Prey in Paper Moon.
Right.
You know, because she's about the same age, and there was a funeral for a mother. And stuff, so I'm thinking maybe I'm going to make the mother just abscond with a bad guy.
But they might tell Mary Magdalene that she died because they might want to hide the shame. And
oh, this is bending all out of shape. I don't think
you have to be. I mean, you know, I don't know. Your book is your book, yes,
right.
You know, it happens.
Right.
Young girls. Do lose their mothers, right. So
and it does have an impact on them.
Yeah,
and perhaps
yeah.
this is what happens with writers, which is why it takes them 5 years to write their book because the damn thing keeps changing.
Yeah,
all the time.
But I really would hate to have people say, "Oh, it's like Paper Moon," or "It's like Addie Prey."
Well, I'd be really flattered.
No,
if somebody told me that my writing was like somebody that had done that well.
Mom and Wife with Straightjacket.
Yes, yes, and also I had one on you write on which made comparison with Alexander McCall Smith, and I'm like, yippee!
Really,
I don't have a problem with that. But if it was somebody writing in a Greek village, perhaps the comparison's too close, and I don't want to appear to be derivative or copying. But
that's what I feel. I don't want people to say, "Oh, she's just recreated this," or "Oh, she's plagiarism or something," which is not the reason.
So, do you do a character profile for everybody?
I haven't, but I'm going to have to because, as I said, Eli is like a chameleon.
He's a slippery fish.
I find the pro forma that Steph gave us early on. Incredibly useful, and that's got everything, you know, height, eye colour,
and then
you can refer back
and to biggest like, fear and ambition and,
right, and then if you find yourself, you know, veering away from that, you can either go back and change it or stop going away.
I mean, once I've done it, I don't tend to refer to it again, but
just a starting point.
But I do know it's in my head.
You shouldn't make it a straitjacket for yourself if you'll excuse that pun.
I think I find it useful to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. When I've done it, then
that's it.
Yeah. And then it's easier to say, well, what would Mariana do if Peter did this, or you know, what would Eli do if Mary Magdalene did that? If you know them,
right?
You can't write in a vacuum, can you? I mean, it's in the snowflake method as well to make a biography of your characters, and I just found as soon as none of them were they were just shapes really, one dimensional shapes, and as soon as I started putting background on it, it all got a lot easier.
Mm. Certainly, like that blob wrapping around it. Freestyle.
Well, I mean, you know, that has thrown up that I've got a very glaring gap in
my biography.
No, the thing is, what you're doing is you're writing and you're moving the story along, and you can go back and like you said, we're not really interested in the punctuation at this stage.
Yeah.
And there are gaps, and that's it. I don't think that's a problem, really. Yeah. It's better. I mean, I'm the sort of person who would not move on till that blank is filled.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily a good thing.
Yeah.
You know?
I have that problem, and that's why I don't forget it finished.
Yeah. Sometimes you just have to.
Yeah.
You and I are like that character in Camus who spends 20 years working on the opening sentence of his novel. I get that.
Teresa, do you want to talk to us about we were talking
about minor characters, and I found an article which was originally published in The Guardian in 2012 by Paul Bailey. And he's talking a bit about Dickens' minor characters, and you mentioned Tiny Tim. One of the things that Paul Bailey says about Dickens' minor characters is they aren't minor characters at all, but important elements in the overall conception, which we kind of touched on, haven't we? And he quotes T.S. Eliot saying Dickens' figures belong to poetry, like figures of Dante or Shakespeare, in that a single phrase, either by them or about them, may be enough to set them wholly before us. And often people are characterised...
Terribly humble.
Exactly, exactly. They're characterised by one thing or one habit or one... But you know, and he repeats it, and he does all the things you're not supposed to do, but it becomes a motif and a recurring thing. You know, and he criticises certain TV adaptations for cutting some of the minor characters and taking all the joy out of a piece. He says... Dickens sees things that other writers miss. He might have been a neurologist, so accurate are his descriptions of nervous tics and suddenly, seemingly inexplicable outbursts of temper. So he often has disabled people, doesn't he, that he portrays very sympathetically. And there's the in Our Mutual Friend, there's the character who can only kind of move around by leaning on walls. He goes all around the walls of the riding school and so on. He records truncated, illiterate speech like a rescuing angel, as is the case with Joe, the crossing sweeper, who's one of his grandest creations. That's in Bleak House, isn't it? The poor boy Joe, who has the very pathetic end. He says he's the chronicler of everyday lunacy, that state of near madness the hurt and dispossessed assume as a carapace to protect themselves from the sane enemies in their midst. And he's not afraid to suggest that there are human beings who are skin deep. So, he'll have somebody who's characterised by being oleaginous, and they're always oily, and everything about them is oily. And they can appear one-dimensional, but it works for Dickens. And he says, just as you're tiring of Dora or Agnes in David Copperfield, your heart is allowed to leap at the prospect of yet another scene with the odious Uriah Heep.
Ever so humble. And his hands are rolling over themselves.
Exactly. You can see it. This is a quote. He's quoting T.S. Eliot here. Dickens can, with a phrase, make a character as real as flesh and blood. And Bailey chooses a sentence from Mrs. Gamp as... exemplifying that. So just with a phrase, you understand the reality of this character. She becomes human. When Gamp was summoned to his long home, and I see him a-lying in Guy's hospital with a penny piece on each eye and his wooden leg under his left arm, I thought I should have fainted away, but I bore up. And that's Mrs. Gamp, you understand.
But I bore up.
I got over it. I dealt with it.
So that was, I thought, quite an interesting article.
So we'd like to hear about your secondary characters. Perhaps you'd like to go on to our Facebook group, Write Club the Podcast, and tell us about your secondary characters and what's going on there. We're nearly at the end. That's another podcast almost done. But before we go, let's ask Laura Marshall, who wrote Friend Request and Three Little Lies, to tell us what's on her bedside table.
Well, at the moment, I'm reading Rattle by Fiona Cumins. I actually get sent a lot of books now, which is a lovely side effect of having had a book that's done quite well. But actually, I mean, the pile just grows and grows. I get so many. So the other day I thought, you know, I haven't hardly bought any books recently because I feel like I can't until I've kind of done my homework, which is reading all the books I've been sent. Obviously, I realise it's a nice problem to have. I rebelled and actually bought a book that I really wanted to read because I'd heard such good things about it, which was Rattle. It's probably not the sort of book I normally do. I do really like psychological thrillers and psychological suspense. This is more of a sort of serial killer book. Although I'd say it's more than that as well. But it's got a very scary baddie, very dark and sinister. I don't know if you've read it yourself, have you?
I haven't, no.
No. He leads an ordinary life some of the time. He has a past which explains his behaviour most of the time. He has a hobby too terrible to understand all of the time. Etta is a detective who suspects him. Erdman and Lilith are parents who fear him. and Jakey and Clara have something he craves. The collector has come to rattle their bones and he won't stop until he's caught. So,
wow, I want to read it.
Yeah. he's got a very macabre museum, which he is looking for items for his collection. I won't say any more than that because I can't remember if that's how much of a spoiler that would be. So it's very dark and sinister, but actually it's also got a real emotional heart. There's the detective investigating the case, you know, we get to know really well, and also the families of there's two children that have gone missing, and we get to know their families and what they're going through. So, you know, it very much has an emotional heart. It's not just a kind of gory, scary tale, you know, although it is quite gory, but it is quite scary and dark and sinister. Very good.
Fabulous.
And Heather, what's on your bedside table?
Well, several things are not finished, unfortunately. I keep finding something else good to read, but I'm actually just about to start Private Peaceful, which is by Michael McPurgo. It says, Private Peaceful is a novel for older children by Michael McPurgo, first published in 2003. Although this novel is for older children, it's also regarded as a great book for young adults. Yeah. And we should then put geriatrics. it's about a soldier called Thomas Tomo Peaceful, who's looking back at his life in the trenches of World War One in France. Structurally, each chapter of the book brings the reader closer to the present until the story turns to present tense. The story especially underlines the senselessness of war and ineptitude of the commanding officer. And I don't know if anybody else has either read it or...
I'm in the process of reading it. Right.
The stage play I went to see at home not that long ago is absolutely fantastic. Yeah. It made me cry. So
he's the guy that wrote War Horse, isn't he?
Yes.
So he's obviously got some... credentials there.
I mean, the theatre was full of children because it is written for children. It's obviously been read in schools, and you could hear a pin drop. The kids, all of the children, were absolutely, you know, mesmerised by the whole thing. And it's just one man on stage, and he never leaves the stage even during the interval. Wow. He sits there.
Who played it?
I don't know the name of the character, the actor who did it, but he was absolutely
fantastic.
Well, he
must be a brilliant actor. That is hard. That is hard to be on stage on your own.
Yes. Yeah.
Thank you. Well, it's time to say goodbye for another week. Next week, we'll be back for episode 43, where we're going to celebrate the start of Black History Month. In the meantime, don't forget, if you're not already subscribed to this don't forget, if you're not already subscribed to this podcast, please do. And please share it with your friends. The more of us there are, the better. So until next time, bye.
Bye.